again to be sure that I'm getting a good enough recording. I'd like to get a little background. For one thing, I'd like you to review for me when it was you came to the farm worker ministry and how long you were with the ministry.
I think it was about 1973, and I was involved with the ministry for about a year, about one full year. So it started, I could be off one year or the other, it was either 72 and 73 or 73 and 74.
Mm-hmm. So when did I graduate from seminary? 74.
Probably was 73, 74. Okay. June to June. June of 73 to June of 74. So it was the heart of the Safeway grape and lettuce boycotts.
Jeez.
Wild and, you know, very intense level of boycotting going on. Tremendous level of activity.
Where were you in seminary?
I had been at Fuller.
Okay.
And I transferred to San Anselmo.
Mm-hmm.
And I did the third year at San Anselmo, which involved an intensive internship. And I wanted to do something in the area of social action. And so I asked the National Farm Worker Ministry to take me on as an intern. And Chris Hartmeyer then was my internship field advisor.
Mm-hmm. How did you find out about the Farm Worker Ministry?
Well, I can't really remember. I think, I was living in Southern California. I was somewhat aware of, concerned about the farm workers, but not a whole lot. I mean, I took the initiative to find out about it and to call the office and to check it out. I had not had any firsthand contact until I went to work with the farm workers. I had not been a volunteer. I had not been in a picket line. I had not spoken or heard a spokesman for the farm workers. So it was just essentially from almost nothing to immersion.
From almost everything.
Yeah. My first day was going down to a meeting somewhere, and this is, it's hard to understand this now because I know the context, but when you don't know the context, to approach an organization as an outsider, all you have are your previous experiences in organizations, which are either churches or other voluntary associations like the YMCA or business institutions. And so I can only picture going to new organization as one of those categories.
Mm-hmm.
So my first day was to go and report to work, and I went down to this, I was given this address for a house that had a name, the, you know, Walga House or something. I forgot.
Harvard House.
And as I was driving along the freeway, here was this beat up large old home near the freeway with a huge farm worker flag hanging out in front of it. And that's, you know, reporting to work was going into this beat up old home, dilapidated old home, filled with people who were just basically in the process of living. And so as the early morning meeting began, there were children running around and wild-eyed people, kind of. I mean, I felt like a real foreigner in a foreign land at that moment. I was just trying to do my thing. I was really embarrassed and shy. Quietly sat on the couch, waiting to see what would happen next.
So then, how did that experience develop for you?
Well, I was living in Pasadena, and so I was kind of recycled right back with working on the San Gabriel Valley boycott. And I was assigned to work with Bobby De La Cruz and a handful of other people. Wish I could remember all of their names, I've kind of forgotten. And basically, our assignment was, here's a map of Los Angeles. Somewhere off to the east of this map is an area called the San Gabriel Valley. God bless you. It was sort of like, God bless you, God damn it. And it wasn't much more than that. And it was, now here's a, and then a newspad, kind of like you've got, a little 3.5 by 5 note booklet. And now we think out there somewhere there's a a Quaker organization in Pasadena. So when you get to Pasadena, call them and see what you can do. And here's the name of two people that send us money. And that was about it, you know. Typical. I think that was pretty typical.
Sure it was.
And so then here we all get into this car, and I'm
like,
sitting in this
like
car.
Like about how many?
Oh, about, you know, a full car. Six people get into a little old Dodge Dart with the hubcaps off, and with boycott and strike signs sticking out of the trunk that's roped shut with a piece of twine. And off we go to the San Gabriel Valley just to see what's going to happen. And so we drive into town, and Bobby gets out and uses the phone, and the slow process of getting inside the community begins. And actually, Bobby had previous experience, so in some ways, as strange as that would seem if you didn't know anything, he actually knew kind of what would happen.
Was he in charge of the team at that
mm-hmm,
point?
Mm-hmm. And there were, there were about six people. It grew to eight or nine. All of these were, you know, volunteers in the total sense of the word, the absolute volunteers. And they were everything from sweet Hispanic people who just knew a couple of words of English, who didn't know anything about being in the city, and really didn't quite know what it was they were a part of. It's just they had decided to jump in the stream and off they were going over the rapids, you know. I mean, they didn't know what they were doing either.
Were they
and,
farm workers?
Yeah, farm workers. Who had, I'm not sure where they had heard the call, but somewhere along the line they decided to walk off of a job and join a strike or something, and they were persuaded that they'd take the risk and go tell their story, and got in a car with a bunch of strangers, and, you know, that wild participation that people would just do with their lives. These farm workers would just do crazy things, remarkable things with their lives. And then it had everything from that to seminary students who were, you know, involved. There weren't any on our team, but there were others involved that summer. To college students who were doing a summer project and were just, you know, real bright, kind of heading down the road of success and taking a month off to go to California and pick it, you know. To, sort of people who came to the farm workers, probably because it was the only people that would take them in, people who had deep psychological problems and were misfits and had lots of trauma. And they were given a home and a purpose. And so you were thrust together. And for most of that year, that was a core group of people that would expand or contract and work together, and people would come and go. But there was a very family-like dimension. You know, you had to work together, and most of them lived together and lived in a house together and bought gasoline together and had to manage a budget together and go talk to strangers together, and all out of this little beat-up Dodge Dart that someone had donated.
What kind of hours did you
have? It would vary a lot, but they were, I think we would usually start about 7:30 in the morning was the kind of call-in time to show up, and we'd meet in this, generally in that home during most of the year. And there would be some variety to the day. The major items were working on picket lines in front of targeted areas, working in church support, and actually I spent more and more of my time during the year doing that. So it would start early in the morning and go till through the evening, 6 days a week.
What was your experience with getting church support for the boycott in the San Gabriel Valley?
We were given a couple people to work with, and some of these were Catholic sisters who lived out here, Jean Eilers, mm-hmm. and did you remember her?
Mm-hmm.
And
she works for AFSCME now.
What that is?
It's I don't know. It's one of the unions for federal employees, I think. I think it's for federal employees.
And then who's become an Episcopal priest now at All Saints?
Short.
Yeah.
I know exactly who you mean.
a little lightning bolt
yes.
of a person.
Yes.
Yeah, that's her name.
Marvelous.
Yeah, tremendous. So I forgot. An interesting experience for me was my first real experience in being in an ecumenical environment. You know, my own roots and background were very fundamentalist and conservative. And I still was, if not on the surface, beneath the surface, working through fundamentalist prejudices, which were not in my operative mode, but were still questions to be answered underneath, you know. And I can remember engaging in these fascinating theological discussions with, you know, Catholic nuns, for example, on picket lines, when we would have discussions about should Christian witness include evangelism or not, you know. And out of my background, well, of course it should, you know. It's almost as though you should say, please help the farm workers that don't shop in the store, and do you know Jesus, you know.
And there's. That would be a variant I never heard.
Yeah. Well, I certainly felt myself very comfortable with fundamentalists mm-hmm. because it had been my own background. I had no hesitation in engaging them in discussion and challenging their instincts to avoid, you know, fundamentalists and evangelicals and mainstream people that I'm familiar with. It didn't bother me to start talking to those folks right away. and the Catholic tradition, which is has deep roots in quiet servitude, you know, was new to me and hard to understand, but wonderful to be around. It engaged me in the real breadth of the Christian tradition at its grassroots, non-institutional level. It was a real neat experience. Well, the church organization part, there was essentially no training for anything. It was basically just try this and go do that. Try to find a place to work out of and do what you need to do and find some money to support wherever you work out of. And you just literally turned loose and to do your own thing, which probably was real valuable. But so you would have to find ways to get, you know, churches and ask to speak to groups and arrange to speak to them and arrange for people to be there and try to figure out what might work and then get permission to ask for money and then try to answer their questions about the farm workers and invite them to participate in the boycott and invite them to join picket lines and invite them to come hear speakers. And mostly what it was an invitation to lay everything on the table, you know. Share with us what your Christian views and beliefs are and what you believe or don't believe about the farm workers. We're willing to talk about anything. You name it, we'll talk about it. And what we want to do is tell you about the farm workers and what they're going through and invite you to participate. And that's going to be our bottom line. And no holds barred, you know. You have a question, ask it. Feel free. Anything is okay. So it was a very freeing experience.
Mm-hmm. What kind of response did you get, or what was the range of responses?
There was a time, of course, the early 70s was a time of tremendous response from students mm-hmm. and community in general. There was, I think, a new social awareness sort of spreading across the country, and people were curious about those kinds of issues. Caesar, being representative of the farm workers, was a famous name that everyone would know, virtually everyone would know the name immediately. And you would always get, in a church, if you went to just a wide open church meeting, you'd just get a gamut of response from a couple people at one end who would say, gee, we've been supporting the farm workers from the very beginning, and, you know, here's 10 more dollars, and where do we send our checks now, and what can we do to help, and here's a crate of apples, you know, or something like that. To other people who would say, well, we want you to tell us about Caesar's castles in the valley and the Cadillacs that he drives, and how can you associate with a communist? You know, which actually were very delightful questions because they were easy to answer because you could just tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always very powerful.
Yes.
Even if...
And comfortable.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. One of the incidents that made a real strong impression on me in working with the farm workers was after a had been a rally in Los Angeles, and Caesar had been in town, and this house where we worked and some people were living, it was filled with farm workers, children, crazy people, college students, and seminary students. I mean, it just had this incredible gamut of humanity under this roof. And there was a party. In fact, it was a wedding. It was Jim Drake's wedding. That's when it was. And afterwards, some of the party went on kind of into the wee early hours. And some of the behavior was a little rambunctious and maybe a little bit out of line, a little inappropriate. Certainly nothing that college students wouldn't feel free to do anywhere, anytime, and never be challenged on. Immediately, there was, you know, the word came back. I mean, everybody who lived there was called together. There was a confrontation, and people, it was just laid on the line that nothing was going to go forward till everything that had happened the night before was laid on the table and dealt with and put aside. And those people were vigorously challenged to live their lives by the highest possible standards, even higher than their own standards, but even to live up to the standards that others watching them might need to see. You know, and it was very remarkable to see this. And of course college students felt defensive. And of course that also was an issue for college students, especially in those days. You know, their independence was a very critical kind of issue. But they were, you know, they were eventually given the choice of that they could either live by these standards, and they were welcome to have a conversation about it. But these were the standards, and this is the way the farm worker would be, their work would be if they were the farm workers. And if not, thank you very much and goodbye. And it was just very, very clear that there wasn't going to be any tolerance for stuff that might be damaging to the work of the farm workers, period. Very stringent standards.
Who called that together?
Jim Drake.
About his own wedding party. Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, these people have been celebrating his wedding, exactly. And then I remember a follow-up conversation to that was Caesar, with a larger gathering, explaining the importance of keeping your hands clean. Mm-hmm. And he held his hands kind of in an open sort of way. That when you go to people and you ask them to give you something, you have to go with your hands clean. And what he was talking about was the fundamental issue of integrity, that when people come from deep integrity, then they are secure in a very rock place, real hard place to stand on when you have something to ask for. And if you don't have integrity, then of course you're coming from a very soft, mushy kind of place. It made a very, very strong impression on me. I've never forgotten that virtually anything can be approached. I mean, my gosh, in the 70s, there were a few things more controversial than the farm workers. It was just as radical and controversial thing as there was on the planet. But you could engage virtually anybody or any group in a conversation about it if you come from real integrity, mm-hmm. which was absolutely part and parcel of Caesar's, you know, commitment. And then that was a requirement for the staff. Mm-hmm. Didn't mean that people didn't screw things up, which they did regularly, but constantly the call then was to go back and to be re-anchored and to start over with integrity, to clean things up and start over. Well, that's got the gospel written all over it. You know, I mean, that's very, very powerful.
Yes.
Force, very, very powerful force.
As you think back to those experiences that you had with the farm worker movement, don't fabricate anything for this event, but what, if any, lasting influence has there been either on your social views or your political views and on your theological point of view? Did it have any? I know it was only a year.
Well, the integrity issue has had a deep impact on my life since then. That because the gospel, because the church is about a very radical call to reorder human society, that the church, which to the degree that it works at that message, has to come from integrity. That's been very, very important to me ever since then. Mm-hmm. And that the standards the church lived lives by have to be immaculate standards, and that whenever there's a lack of integrity, then everything kind of goes out the window. And so, for example, when someone in the church gives their word that they're going to do something, I've always felt like that has to be radically kind of followed. That if a representative of the staff of the church says we're going to do this or do that, then everybody else is bound by that person's word. Once someone has given their word, that's just the way it has to be, whether it's a good decision or a bad decision, because the integrity of the institution is at stake. And the critical areas in personal ethics and finance and institutional the institutional nature of the church, its finances, the way it runs its business side, have to be immaculate, you know, for the church to have any power. And cleaning up the act of the church is something it has to look at all the time at a very, very vigorous standard if it's going to be part of a real spiritual force.
Doesn't it seem kind of ironic that she would feel that one of the important lessons you learned from a ragtag farm worker movement was the importance for the church to have the kind of integrity that you saw in that movement?
Yeah, except I'd like to think that the farm workers is a product of the church.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to some degree it is. Mm-hmm. That the roots and history of that sense of call to Caesar's life and to others who rallied around it are deeply rooted in the church.
Mm-hmm.
And that, so in that sense, any messages the farm workers have to the church are brothers and sisters speaking to each other. I mean, it's within the family, even though in some, you know, important degrees, the farm workers is a very secular institution. In another sense, in the biggest sense of the word, it's not. It's a very spiritual institution. And it's both an institution and a spiritual, spiritually rooted purpose, mm-hmm. as is the church. And to some degree, yes, I mean, you would think that the institutional church might be the mother of all calls to integrity. The truth of the matter is that such calls come from different places.
How about other impacts for you personally?
I think one of the major shifts going on in the world today is for at least the Reformed tradition, and for mainstream traditions, is a new awareness of the calling of the church to be a servant to those who are oppressed. And while that idea has been floating around Christian circles through all the centuries, and it's been embodied in the Catholic traditions and here and there in other aspects of Protestant tradition, it has always been sort of as an aside or as a product of the theology of the church, as opposed to literally in the heart of the church. And I believe that we're moving toward the integration of that as an ongoing, deeply rooted, centered concern in the life of the church, that in its theology is God's love and concern for the poor and the oppressed. And the first person that I ever heard that from was Chris Hartmeyer. I mean, Chris Hartmeyer, in a little, you know, off-the-record talk about, I remember going with him one day to talk to a bishop up in the valley, and I just rode with him. He invited me to go along just to listen in. And we chatted about the church and theology and everything else on the way up and on the way back. And in that conversation, he used the phrase talking about the biblical preference for the poor and the oppressed. And I had never heard that language used before. That was my introduction to it. Now, of course, that language has been around for a long time. Chris didn't invent it. But that was, for me, that was the first time I had heard it. And the context of hearing it was not in the context of being in a seminary classroom. The context of hearing it was being with a Presbyterian minister who was giving his life to live with and be with, not intellectually, but with his whole being, with poor people. And that which is very, very powerful. Very, very powerful experience. And it seems to me that that's, you know, that was sort of a forerunner of what has continued to happen in the life of the church. The church keeps having opportunities to hear from and be with poor people who are inviting them to be partners. This year at General Assembly, 83 people from other foreign countries have come to be with and do mission with, you know, the American Church. So there's a new growing awareness of taking our servanthood more and more seriously. The language of the new faith and life statement, or the new mission and life statement of the denomination, has serious language about servanthood and about oppression. So I think that there's a shift in the winds and associations with the farm workers and others that help permeate into the life of the church real experiences of being with poor people.
What did you experience any any other areas of shift as far as your own theological formation? Because you clearly were, you were describing yourself as being in a sort of theological reformulation during that year, as well as your other seminary years.
There's something that I've never, that I have yet to completely integrate, but to be with people who are in the midst of poverty and persecution, literal, not just symbolic, literally, in the midst of that, and yet who tap their deepest visions about life, to see their sense of the celebration of life, that somehow they are the ones whom are truly blessed, was a wonderful experience for me. I've never quite come to terms yet with the mystery of that, you know. But something that cannot be denied, difficult to articulate, suspect by those of us who want to have it both ways, but something that once experienced, you know, it's very profound that people in the midst of persecution and poverty can have a sense of celebration of life that just exceeds anything that I generally know. That I'm more tempted to give into the allurement of wealth and finance and petty power and things like that. And the actual price that I pay is to miss out on the joy of living that folks like farmworker communities demonstrated, you know, to me. Not because they were showing it off to gain support, but simply because being permeated into their interior life, I saw the life itself. You know, I saw the liveliness and the sense of inextinguishable flame about life that was alive in there. That's also a deep spiritual kind of issue. And now I'm hearing reports on refugees and sanctuary work in Central America. And one of the interesting, you know, qualities that emerges in that is that the reports come back from church folks who go to visit and look and see and find out, is that they're astonished at the vitality, at the life, at the even sense of reformation that they're getting out of being with poor and oppressed people. You know, there's something in there very powerful.
That is a remarkable mystery, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Chris has talked about that so often, that he said that, you know, as a person who has just really integrated his own life into the life of the farm worker movement, that he gets so much sustenance from it, that's the payoff. That's what keeps him going.
Integration is the word. That's the word that I would pick. Chris and Caesar and a host of others whom I don't know as well, those I've sort of witnessed, demonstrate a kind of integration of life where instead of the different dimensions of natural life being sort of in tension with each other, they're integrated, and out of that sort of emerges, you know, like an atomic reaction or something, a whole new sort of resource power or something that's very remarkable to see. I mean, most of us kind of put work in a corner and hold that in some degree of tension with our private life and in some degree of tension with our family and in some degree of tension with, you know, a recreation or whatever, and kind of play those off of each other and against each other. And Caesar is the one that I watched this with the most, but I mean, there was an incredible integration of all those dimensions into one, so that his sense of play in life and his work in life and his family and his nurture and his giving were all integrated, thoroughly integrated. I mean, you just cannot separate them out. We were living in a house in Altadena during that year, and Caesar was coming to town, and they wanted to find some place for him where he could be kind of out of the limelight for an evening and the next morning before he went off and spoke at all these things. And so he arrived at our house with this huge entourage of people and dogs and, you know, on and on and on it went. The neighborhood just really wondered what was going on. And so what did Caesar spend the entire, all of his time and energy, I mean, almost 100% of it was talking and dreaming about the farm workers. I mean, that was his recreation, was to talk and dream about the farm workers and to dream about what they had to offer to people. I mean, just the interplay was so powerful that it continually motivated him.
Is there anything else that you would like me to know about your experience, either at the time or it's...
During that time in the life of the church, that the farm workers touched the lives of thousands of people. I mean, there were thousands of people who were given the very crisp, straightforward invitation to either, or all of the above, donate money, boycott, or join a picket line. And people went home and made a choice of either to do those things or not do those things. And when they made those choices, what they did was they allowed themselves for even one flicker of a moment to be literally and concretely involved in the work of poor and oppressed people in the world. Or they chose not to. So they participated in one of the biggest spiritual issues in their life at that moment, whether they knew it or not. And it was very clear. It wasn't an intellectual discussion. It wasn't a cocktail hour conversation. It was a concrete thing that they did in their life, which is very, very powerful. And that was one of the great gifts of the farm workers. Because the farm workers went to folks and said, look, if you want to study this, go ahead. Fine. Study it from now until after your death. You can study it from now into eternity if you want to. But that's not what we're asking you to do. If you want to help farm workers, you have to do one of these things. You have to give money to them, or you have to walk in a picket line, or you have to participate in the boycott. And studying them doesn't help them. Thinking about this doesn't help them. Buying posters and hanging them on your wall doesn't necessarily help them. But participation in these very crisp and clear things is what the farm workers need. And people either did that or didn't do that. And I think what that is, it was in an era when the church had really lost its sense of discipline. Couldn't have wanted anything. I mean, the last thing the church wanted in the 60s was the word discipline. But what that movement did was it allowed people to do something that really comes out of the tradition of the ancient disciplines of the church, which is you take your vague kind of ideas and then you practice them very, very, very specific ways. Well, that was powerful for me. I think it was a very powerful experience because it is spiritual. That is a spiritual thing to do, to make that decision, even if it's only for an instant. And thousands of people had that experience of doing something that is fully integrated in what the gospel calls us to do. You know, maybe they just did it for a second. Maybe they just did it once. Maybe they passed up grapes at their friend's house. It could have been very, very minute, but they fully experienced it for that moment, something very powerful in their lives. I'm confident of that. Secondly, it was a great lesson about taking the abstract notions of the gospel and the kingdom and making them very, very concrete. Albert Schweitzer's book, in his writings, I forgot the name of the book now, in his writing about the contrast of Christianity to Buddhism, it's he talks about how interesting and exciting the writings of Buddha are and the teachings of Buddhism. He says, but generally the writings always end up by saying something like, well, these teachings and these ideas are really just for the priests. Mm. And one of the compelling things about Christianity is that it belongs to the folks, that it's grassroots, it's for everyone. It's not esoteric, it's not airy-fairy, it's not pie in the sky, it's not left up to the abstract theologians. It's up to anybody and everybody who can have it, be a part of it. They don't have to be theologians. They can experience it. It was deeply rooted in that experience.
Good. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Fun to think about it.
Good.